It's surprising that when biblical scholars go to the cinema, they find themselves reading. And earlier this year, of course, despite our mother's warnings that it's dangerous to read in the dark, we found ourselves compelled to do so as biblical scholars, thanks to the much anticipated, widely denigrated, and I suppose long-awaited release of The Passion. And for a change, biblical scholars found themselves reading the same thing that everybody else was, which is kind of nice for a change, which perhaps explains why, at $350 million and counting, Gibson's text has probably made quite a bit more than our texts. It was in the early 1890s, long before semiotics would recognize the text of the film, that the fledgling industry first recognized the importance of the text behind the film. Perhaps fittingly, one of these first texts was in fact The Passion, a stage play written in 1879 and adapted for the screen as The Passion Play of Oberammergau, a film which might well have been shot in Germany if it hadn't been cheaper to do it in New York. Ever since then, it's safe to say that almost everything that audiences have seen on the screen has been a realization, for better or for worse, of what's been written for the screen. And while it's a commonplace to observe that a film always consists of more than its screenplay, it's equally obvious that it never consists of anything less than its screenplay. But when we give the screenplay our attention, it redirects it, as all texts do, to other texts which stand not so much behind it as in the very midst of it. An acknowledgement of this intertextuality requires us to read screenplays as texts which are written by previous texts and subsequent readers, as much as they are by their authors. Discouraged by the fact that the biblical authors themselves are long gone, as we know, and declared dead by Barthes, even if they weren't long gone, biblical scholars persist in asking questions of authors, even when the only ones around to answer them are us, the biblical scholars themselves. In the case of The Passion, of course, we're glad to announce that while many readers have been born, as Barthes would say, the authors are not dead. And in fact, we're also happy that at least two of the ones who've been involved in this project were able to join us this evening. Dr. William Foucault, just to my left, teaches in the Department of Classics and Archaeology at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. In addition to holding posts at University of California, Berkeley, and Loyola Marymount, Bill has been the Asor Professor in Amman, Jordan, and the Catholic Biblical Association Annual Professor at the École Biblique in Jerusalem, and has published widely in ancient Near Eastern studies. Ben Benedict Fitzgerald, just next over, has been writing for the screen, both big and small, for over 25 years, beginning with the adaptation of Flannery O'Connor's novel Wise Blood for John Huston in 1979. His writing over the past decade has included Zelda, a biopic on F. Scott Fitzgerald, as well as adaptations of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, starring John Malkovich, and Herman Melville's Moby Dick. And he co-wrote the screenplay of The Passion of the Christ with the film's director and producer, Mel Gibson, as you know. I'm also pleased to have with me two scholars whose passion for reading the Bible on film predates the release of this year's Passion, by some distance, I think. After teaching most of the 90s at Stanford University, Dr. Alice Bach took up her current position in the Department of Religion at Cleveland's Case Western Reserve University. Over the course of her career, Alice has been an important catalyst for biblical studies' increasing interest in Bible and film, as anyone familiar with her 1996 Semeia volume, Biblical Glamour and Hollywood Glitz, will testify. Dr. Clayton Jefford, on the end, teaches scripture at St. Meinrad School of Theology in Indiana. And while Clayton's perhaps maybe best known for his work in patristics and his exploration of early Christian literature, he also found time to collaborate with two colleagues at St. Meinrad's on the text that some of you may use, A Savior on the Silver Screen, a textbook that I think is both accessible and, you know, pretty insightful. My name's David Shepherd. I teach biblical languages and literature at Briarcrest College and Seminary. That's up in Canada, just north of here. A long way north of here, actually. And my interests in biblical Bible and film are currently focused on the representation of biblical narrative in the earliest years of the cinema, between 1897 and 1910. Tonight, though, we'd like to take the opportunity to talk a bit to Bill and Ben about the process of moving from the scripture to the screenplay behind The Passion. Clayton, Alice, and I are going to be asking some questions, taking some turns, and then following up sometimes when we feel the need. And I think just to get us started, I was wondering whether you guys could give us a sense for how you got involved with the project and what your contributions were, briefly.
Well, I had known Mel Gibson socially, but I had never worked with him or for him, really. But he liked, I think he liked, and his producer had liked some of my ideas for film, which were never realized. Also Wise Blood, which...
John Huston's film,
came out in 1980, and he called me up. I was living in Italy at the time, and he just called me up out of the blue, basically on this, I think it was Steve McAbee's suggestion. He called me up and said, why don't you come and see me? There's something I want to talk to you about. And I went, of course, little did I know. But I knew a little bit, but I didn't quite know how far this was going to go or how big it was going to be, and nor how difficult it was going to be, because it was. And we met, and I think about a week afterwards, you know, we just talked as two fellows talk. And he just said, why don't you just go and try and write a first draft, which I did. And after that, we began to collaborate.
Right, so you actually went away and wrote...
I wrote the first draft.
He didn't bring you a draft and say, touch this up?
No. Right. He said, you go ahead and do this, and then we'll work on it.
Okay.
Give me more than less. Let everything come out. And I gave him something that was, I think, 280 pages long and unreadable. But this was 15 hours, after all, and the last 15 to 18 hours in our Lord's life on earth. So there was something there to work on, and I thought long and hard about it, but mainly at first as just a storyteller, inspired by some of the people that I'd read, Emmerich, Agreda, and so on, but basically as a storyteller, you know, trying to stick to the Gospels, but also be free.
Mm-hmm. So that's how you kind of got involved in the first
place.
That's
how I got involved in the first place.
Bill?
I was sitting at my office at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles and got a call from Icon. I'd never heard of Icon Productions. And a person on the phone said, would you do something for us in Aramaic? And I said, well, what is it? He said, we want a commitment first. Well... I said, well, I'm going to Jerusalem tomorrow for a couple of weeks. I said, can we talk about it when I get back? I said, fine. So I was sitting in Jerusalem, and I got the phone call. Hey, Padre, it's Mel. I said, Mel who? I said, Mel Gibson. And he told me what the project was, and I couldn't resist. My contribution ended up growing quite a bit, I think.
Well,
I hope.
My God, yeah.
So I was in from the very beginning when Ben and Mel first met after the first draft of the script in Rome. Mel kindly brought me into every phase of it, even up to the music. So I was flying back and forth to Matera in Rome. So my job was the translation, but the translation frequently will influence very much the meaning of the, you know, of how it's acted and so on. So I had to coach all the actors for the Aramaic and the Latin. I started out with some Greek, but we dropped that. Also advising on theological and archaeological concerns. For example, you should have a one-humped camel, and if you saw the film, you notice there's a two-humped camel in the film, which is outrageous.
That's what I thought when I saw it. That is outrageous.
Outrageous.
Really.
Historically inaccurate, that's right.
I won some ballots, I lost some, and we discussed a lot of how to handle the resurrection. I lost that battle.
Yeah, you're not the only one who lost that battle.
No.
No, right, okay.
And so, in general, I kept in contact with Mel. I see him almost every week, as a matter of fact. So.
Right, okay, good. That gives us a good sense to start from. Alice.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you a one-half question. and this is primarily a question for Ben as a screenwriter. I don't know how... What did you think you were doing when you were writing this screenplay? I'll leave it at that. What did you think?
I think the first thing I should say about that is that I was remembering. Nothing to do with screenwriting, but I think as a human being, I was simply remembering how I was brought up. And in a sense, in a very... I don't know if this is embarrassing to say or not, but I'm not embarrassed to say that I was going back to a time in which all of this was unquestioningly credible to me. All of it. Everything. I simply opened up to the sort of faith that children have and let that influence me with the added help of years of experience writing screenplays, which combined turned out a pretty good job, turned out a pretty good draft. Wouldn't you say, Bill?
I would certainly say.
That's basically what I was doing. I was remembering how I thought of this when I was a child. The Gospels can be... those 15 hours can bring a grown man to tears, and a child can definitely feel them twice as... twice as touched by it. And that's what I was trying to go for.
So when you were a child, if I could follow up on this, you thought more of the passion than of the other elements of Jesus' life. You were more focused on the passion.
Well, I had to be, because that was Mel's, his conceit was, let's just stick to... We'll start this in Gethsemane and we'll end it on the cross. And I actually talked him into, I think Bill was against this at one point, talked him into doing a resurrection as it happens, insofar as one can do this on film. I talked him into that, based on a picture I had seen in Florence by Andrea del Sarto. It's a beautiful fresco. Called Gesù in Pietà, and it's a picture of our Lord as he's come back to life, staring at his hands, just alone in the tomb. And there's something very powerful and very beautiful in that picture by Andrea del Sarto, which I thought maybe we could get on film as a motion picture. And I think Mel's idea of coming in with the light and moving towards the slab of stone upon which the body had been laid, and the watching the linens just fall, and then finding our Lord seated there as the light touches him, was a good picture, very close to what I had in mind. I would have liked to have seen it a frontal view as well, with the puzzled expression that Andrea del Sarto managed to get into his picture, which was very powerful because it was a combination of man and God. It was really something that had merged those two, rather like the fingers in Michelangelo's work. It was beautiful, and I wanted to get something like that. Does that make sense? Does it answer the question?
little bit?
Sure.
Okay.
Were you? I'm kind of curious then, in a sense, because when Alice asked the question, what were you doing? And I think in some sense, we've been wondering, you know, were you writing, was this a historical?
No.
Was this a historical film?
No.
Was
the reason I work as a screenwriter is because I don't write text. And this is interesting for you, because I don't think of it as text. It's not to be published. It's not to be read. It's meant to evoke in a series of different categories of mestiere, jobs, a response. And first in a director, then in the actors, then in a costume designer, then in a set designer, then in a whole series of people. And it's an evocation. It's not a text.
Right.
A screenplay is not a text. In this particular instance, it has been, you know, has been read as a text, but it's not.
Right.
No film screenplay is. It doesn't pretend to be that. My father was a poet and a translator of text. But strangely enough, even he was translating Homeric poems, which were an oral tradition. This wasn't text either.
Yeah. You've adapted several things. You've adapted several classics for the screen, right? I mean, we talked about them.
Destroyed the text.
And I mean, how does this compare? Adapting this classic, what is in every sense? I mean, in every sense, a classic. How does it compare with adapting other classics for the
screen? It's more frightening.
Really? More frightening than Flannery O'Connor?
Well, she was funny. She was just plain fun.
Scared? You said scared?
Well, it was frightening because, you know, from the get-go, I mean, this is probably why I was trying to reduce myself, redux to childhood, because if I'd actually thought as an adult about, you know, what for instance, is happening right now, which is I'm confronting people that know awful lot more about all of this than I will ever know, because you spent all your lives doing it, thinking about this, and I would have been paralyzed with fear. In addition to which, of course, there's the matter of faith, which was slowly coming back to me during the course of this work, and succeeded in really filling me. Mm. And in that sense, it was really a remarkable experience, as the film turned out to be as well.
Mm-hmm. Clayton, I think you had a question.
Yeah, I have a question. Considering the fact that the story really that you presented is the passion, per se, would you talk a little bit about the narrative strategy that you went through, particularly with respect to the flashback aspects?
Well, this was something that Mel and I talked about from the outset, that often in the course of these 15 hours it was going to have to be the people around our Lord, not what was happening to him, that was going to be controlling the story. Peter's reaction to things, or Mary's reaction to things, Mary Magdalene's reaction, or simply their point of view, John's, Caiaphas, Annas. We decided that we had to, in the course of telling the story of the last 15 hours, we had to have something that was comprehensible, even though the film was going to be in Aramaic, so that it eventually ended up being with subtitles as a result of this. But you had to understand what was going on with both Caiaphas, Annas, and the small group of Pharisees and Sadducees that were intent on having Jesus condemned, and, for instance, Pilate and his wife. There had to be subtitles, so that those things would be understood. But for the rest, for instance, the flashbacks to the Last Supper were essentially establishing the sacraments. Do you think that's true? Don't you find that that was what was happening?
Me?
Yeah, I'm asking. I mean, when you saw those flashbacks, did you see the sacraments being established?
I didn't think of it that way, but now that you say it, I'm...
That's what we were doing. I mean, we
okay,
were.
Okay, I'm sorry that I missed what you were doing.
They just turned out, they just were flashbacks for you.
So much of it for me was, as we discussed earlier among ourselves, was the Stations of the Cross.
Yeah.
When you went back to the supper, it wasn't really establishing. It wasn't establishing a sacrament for me. It was just. It's hard to say when you're so familiar with something and you go back. It didn't.
It didn't do that, huh? Well, that's.
But now that you say it, of course it did.
Well, John's recognition of what was going on at the Last Supper happens during the last part of the Via Crucis, the Way of the Cross, so that. He's recognizing the words as having a significance other than what he thought they had meant. That's what we were trying to get across. Obviously, not altogether successful.
I was wondering. You mentioned the Aramaic, and we talked about it a little bit. And I think that often the language has turned out to be a kind of red herring. Oh well, you know. Oh, the Aramaic wasn't quite right. Ah, that means I can dismiss the, you know, obviously scholarly credibility is out the window then. But I have to, I'm dying to know, really when it comes right down to it, why not Greek? Honestly, really, why not Greek?
Oh, there are a couple of reasons. I started to do some of the translations into Greek, as a matter of fact. Because Mel's original instructions to me is do whatever languages are appropriate for the conversation. And some I thought was between... Pilate and the elders of the people should have been in Greek as the language of communication at the time. Mel wanted it back in Latin, but it's interesting. There are a couple of reasons why we ended up doing it in Latin. First of all, in terms of the audience, Latin is much more familiar than Greek and gave a sense of comfort to the audience, a sense of being at home, but also gave the sense of being ancient and not being English. So that you're not reading an English mentality or American mentality to Jesus. So it served a double purpose. Greek, on the other hand, would have been unfamiliar and rather jarring. But my main reason for not insisting, because by and large Mel gave in on some of these things if I really pushed it, we talked with our Greek scholars at Loyola Marymount and at UCLA, who said, you know, there's so much controversy about the pronunciation of Koine Greek that no matter what you did, no matter what pronunciation you choose, you'd have 90% of Greeks furious with you. Whereas if Latin, since you have to choose between the two pronunciations, you'd have 50% of the people furious with you.
So you just did the math then,
did
basically.
The math.
Well,
did the math.
Bill, let me ask you something. Was it a conscious play to Catholic familiarity, especially pre-Vatican II Catholics, to hear the Latin?
Surely in Mel's mind, that was a factor. There's no question. He has a love affair with pre-Vatican II Latin.
But that's, and we will pray for him.
Pray for him? I pray for him every day. But that's not bad to have a love affair with pre-Vatican II Latin.
No. As long as you're careful where you say it.
Yeah.
Well, somebody said earlier that it was so Roman. It was such Italian Latin. But there's nothing wrong with that because, you know, this is probably as close to Latin as you can get. It was the first language that came out of Latin.
Well, I got email from somebody. All we had in the trailer so far was Ecce Homo. And I got an email from somebody who said, why are you using this bastardized ecclesiastical Latin? It should have been, of course, Ecce Homo, which is weenie, weedy, weeky, and so on. And he said, I want you to know that I am boycotting this film, and I have written a message to my old Latin teacher, and she's going to boycott this film. So I was really very concerned.
That's two.
Yeah,
that's two.
That
only $350 million later, but those two probably did make quite a difference.
But the actors are mostly Italian, and the ones that weren't Italian were, for the most part, European, Romanian, for example. So they were very familiar with that pronunciation. And it's what they learned in Rome. And for them to have tried even an alternate pronunciation would have been nightmarish. I mean, it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah.
They could have been relatively consistent with this one. So.
Right, and this is quite unique about this film. Obviously, they're using the ancient languages. Quite defamiliarizing for the average North American cinema-goer, right? In that context, Clayton, obviously you've thought a lot about the broad scope of Jesus' films. And I think you were wanting to sort of ask these guys how much. I mean, you had a question on that front.
Well, yeah, the real question is, what movies and screenplays did you take into consideration before you produced this particular movie? Because as I was watching the movie, I kept thinking, you know, this has the sound or the look or feel of other things that I've seen over the years, but I wasn't sure if that was just me having watched too many movies or whether you consciously were building this into the narrative.
I have to confess, not thinking about any of the pictures that had been done previously. I was very aware of Pasolini's work, and without reading his script, saw the film again. But not until I was done with my first draft.
Pier Pasolini's Evangelista according to Matteo.
Yeah, Matthew, according to Matthew. And
his script is...
It's
pretty easy to
very easy to see, but you know, it's very slow going in terms of watching it. In terms of watching it, it's a beautiful film. It's a poem, whereas ours, I think of more as a mass. He was a poet. Pier Paolo Pasolini was a poet, and I think Mel Gibson is more of an altar boy in that sense. You know. Don't you think?
Yeah, there's another factor too. Is regardless of how the script reads, how you direct the film tremendously influences all sorts of things. I mean, you can direct it in a variety of ways. Before beginning shooting, we were in Rome. Were you there at the time we were watching some of these things on the video? We were watching various portrayals of Jesus, and this is one reason why we wouldn't do it in the ancient languages, so you wouldn't read an American or Japanese or French or whatever mentality into Jesus with the language. But some of them were simply absurd. One of them is Jesus was at the Last Supper and sounded like Michael Jackson. I mean, he was about 18 years old, looked like a surfer, and he looked out at the disciples and said, you know, I'm not going to be with you much longer. Well,
are we supposed to guess which particular Jesus film this was?
Maybe you could. So there are largely things to avoid. Mel was very intent on having a macho Jesus in charge. He wanted to make sure that the passion was something Jesus did and it was not something for which he was a victim. That's why, to my mind, the key line of the film, and Mel agrees, is, behold, I make all things new, taken from the book of Revelation. That was a big emphasis of his.
So Jesus. Who wrote that? Who wrote that line?
I was like, I can remember that one.
You put that in, didn't you?
A macho Jesus?
Macho in the sense of not a weakling, you know, of somebody who's a victim, of constantly being, oh my God, what's happening to me now? Which is the way he's portrayed in many films. He wanted to, this is the
not
passion
macho.
Is something
macho
that Jesus
is
did.
Macho is an unfortunate term for me because it sounds much more like Mel Gibson than Jesus.
A poor choice of words. I'll take it back. Let me put it this way. A man of vigor.
Oh, that sounds intriguing. Possibly more Scorsese than Gibson, but...
Weren't. I mean, honestly, I think Mel probably thought about this more than I did. But I was not influenced by other movies. I knew Pasolini's work.
And Scorsese's work?
I didn't like The Last Temptation. I didn't find it. There was only one unforgettable moment for me in it. And that's when Lazarus is called because it's terrifying. Because you're seeing it from Lazarus's point of view, and I thought, my God, that's really good. But I didn't really like the movie, and I like this one more, for whatever it's worth.
And you know. Speaking of Scorsese's film, I mean, we know the reaction. I mean, we know the response. The response to Scorsese's film was very dramatic. I mean, it was very dramatic, especially from. The right and a lot of people, and in fact kind of killed the box office. So there was a real dynamic response to the film. Did you expect the response to the film that eventually came out? Did either of you? You were writing it. You're sitting there writing it. Did you expect that response?
I literally thought this is a vanity movie. I'm writing. In an odd way, I'd removed myself. If I removed myself and thought, I'm writing a movie for Mel Gibson, I thought, well, it's because he wants to do this. And gradually, it became something that I wanted to do. And then I discovered, little by little, that it was something that, you know, everyone who worked on the film wanted to do. This is one of those rare occasions in which there was a unanimity. Cast, crew, and everybody else wanted to do this film, and that's why it became
right. But the response was dramatic.
I never once heard anyone say this is going to be a blockbuster. I don't think anybody thought. I thought people would, you know. I was told by two or three people in Rome, you and Mel will go see this two or three times, and then, you know, that'll be it.
Actually, I thought the same thing. when I heard that it was being, you know, but then again, I never thought Ronald Reagan would be president. But
and you
wait
wrong,
a minute.
You were wrong twice over there.
Is there any kind of connection between the two?
I never have my finger on the pulse of
Oh, I see what you mean.
But when I, and then I heard they're doing it in Aramaic? Oh, yeah. No, nobody's going to go to that.
Yeah. Nobody thought.
You know, that's not going to be anything.
No.
One of the commentators, Paula Fredrickson, said in crowd-pleasing Aramaic, you know.
Crowd-pleasing
Aramaic and oops, Latin.
I'm not sure how Paula knows it's crowd-pleasing Aramaic.
Not true. She knows it now.
But you know, there was a considerable build-up in what Ben was saying in the attitude toward the film amongst the crew itself. Yeah. Mel talked about it being perhaps a small art film. If anybody knows Los Angeles, we're talking in terms of the Lemley Theaters, which is does foreign films and art films. But gradually, as the momentum built, it became almost a sense of wanting to preach Christ crucified, a scandal to Jews and Gentiles alike. You know, it became an obsession with everybody on the crew, and especially those of us who were kind of in the middle of how this thing is going to be produced. It was an extraordinary unity amongst the cast, the crew, the directors. There's a message here we want to proclaim, and it built up gradually.
Yeah. But the response, of course, was not was quite divided. And I know Alice, we talked about before we came onto stage, and Alice, you.
Obviously the hoopla raised by Anti-Defamation League, etc., did not hurt the reception of the film, shall we say. But were you broadsided by the idea that this was anti-Semitic or that this was going to be offensive to large groups of people?
Not really, because I remember the first week we were shooting, an article came out in the New York Times Sunday magazine.
Uncle Frank.
Noxon. No, it was Noxon and them.
Yeah.
No, Frank Rich came later.
That was Frank Rich. That was not Frank Rich. It was some guy who was the son of somebody who really hated Mel Gibson and decided to pretend to be a student of theology and interview the old man and made the connection between the two. In other words, Mel is doing what his father wanted, and his father has certain unholy views. I think that's the best way of putting it, generously.
But as you were writing the script, you must have been aware that at various points, I mean, anybody who's reading, you must have been aware that at various points how is this going to be seen by a Jew? Was that there or not?
No,
there?
I was brought up in Italy where there's no big problem about any of this, you know. This is a I don't have any uh-huh. anti-Semitism in me, uh-huh. so I never thought about this. I thought, well, here are the Pharisees, here are the Sadducees, and they're appointed by Pilate, and they want this man dead because he's going against everything they represent, as far as he's concerned. So they're terrified. It's a really political fight. If I see it this way, then it'll work.
Okay, without, but you know. Clearly, I mean, there are anti-Semitic parts to the gospel. So, I mean, the Gospel of John. Mm-hmm. The people who seem to want you to remove some of that seem to me to be pulling some sort of an ahistorical desire. And I was wondering, Bill, how you felt about that as
I perhaps feel it more strongly than Ben because I got caught. I was the first one to get caught in the
right.
the turn of events. Is that the committee of the Catholic Jewish committee of the bishops? Landed on me first, and my correspondence, email, and everything ended up being subpoenaed, and I'm now famous with the FBI and everything else. I was caught tremendously off guard. I've learned a lot from it in terms of sensitivity, but also in terms of suffering, to be honest. I mean, it was a terrible experience. It was during Easter, during Holy Week of 02 or 03? 03, I guess. 03. But, you know, on the crew itself, I had an assistant. So this is after the script is written and after we have the translation. I had an assistant to work with the language. Evelina McNaghi, who is a Jew, her family's originally from Spain. Their family was kicked out of Spain during the awful period, ended up in Libya. Then her family was kicked out of Libya during the Six-Day War, and she ended up in Italy, where she's now quite a famous a singer of Yiddish folk music and so on. So she helped me with the pronunciation of coaching, because she had a good Arabic and Hebrew tweak, you know. But we kept running things by her. Mel would keep asking her, Evelina, are you finding, what do you think of the way we're doing this scene, of directing it? And occasionally she'd say, that's not the way we would do it. She says, the way you're doing it is, and it's not the script. It's, as I say, the direction makes all the difference in the world from how you're going to handle the script. And so does the translation, even into Aramaic, because it can affect the way it sounds and the interaction between people. But Mel consistently ran it by her, and occasionally she would say, "That's I find that very offensive." And Mel would sit down with her and work out. He said, "Well, why? You know, why would it?" There were some things, for example, with the Last Supper, that she said, "This is you're bowdlerizing the Passover service," and so Mel changed it. So he was very conscious about that all during the filming, and so we were really caught off guard with the barrage that followed right afterwards. Because I think Mel genuinely did his best.
Would you have done it differently? Would he have done it differently?
I don't think so. I think in the context of what Bill is talking about, yes. I mean, he was willing to change the way he was going to set up a scene and represent it. But in terms of the structure of the film, the structure of these last 15 hours as dramatically represented, I don't think so. I think that, you know, it was based on sacred text, and there was no reason in the world to change it. There was nothing in it that was offensive that isn't in the Gospels.
Well, Clayton has a question.
I want to follow that, because my question is, considering that you really have drawn from different Gospel texts, mm-hmm. in addition to a number of other different images and so forth, just exactly what gospel is it that's being presented? I mean, this is a question that comes up quite a bit in response.
Well, I thought of John's gospel most because it seemed to be a portrait of the Son of God. And it meant something to me in that sense, whereas you can say that Marx is a son of man, and you can say that another one, I think Luke is a poem, and wonderful. Matthew's is a teacher, is a rabbi. I liked the Son of God that is represented in John. And I was drawn to that. That doesn't mean that you're not looking at other portraits of the same man, you know, from another perspective, while you're doing something as difficult as this. But those were the texts that really dominated. You know, often people talk about the influence of Catherine Ann Emmerich or Maria Greda on the text. I don't think they were as strong. They were in some, I'll give an example. No one has ever represented the cross being turned over after Jesus has been nailed to it so that the nails can be flattened. But it made a certain amount of sense to us because this is in Agreda. Because if not, his hands could fall out after they were nailed to the nail could just simply fall out. So one of his arms, I mean, that would have been...
Nails will fall out of the 4x4?
Well, it's conceivable. If they're preparing the hole where the nail is in...
They probably were actually in his wrist.
Well, that's one of the theories, and we looked, but
then did you try it several ways?
No, they thought all along that this was is in the palm of the hand. In fact, I think it was Mel who banged the first nail in. He wanted to be part of the movie, so it's his arm that you see coming down. This is something very close to Mel Gibson. I think that he's been thinking about this for a long time. I think probably since he was a child. Before he became Mel Gibson, as we all know him, he was thinking about doing this. Don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
And there's an other aspect of how Mel Gibson did this that I think is interesting from my perspective, and that is that I think he did it also because he's afraid of God. And I think that's very interesting because... I've come around to thinking myself that we ought to be a little bit more afraid of God than we are. We're getting away with too much.
You mentioned Catherine Emmerich, yeah. And obviously quite a bit's been written about the fact. I mean, would it be safe to say this is? I don't know. As a screenplay writer, you're probably going to find this a little bit might not really take to it. But some people have said, well, this is really just. You know, you should best adapted screenplay. I think it was Crossan. Best adapted screenplay of Emmerich.
Oh, I think that's fair.
I mean, is that fair? Not fair?
No, it's not fair because I think Emmerich is very powerful. By the way, I mean, if you were to sit and read Catherine Emmerich. You know, on a quiet afternoon at home, you would burst into tears halfway through it and be unable to stop crying. On the other hand, there's a side of her that is, first of all, it's not her. It's somebody who wrote what she said. Mm. And there's one aspect of the texts that really irritated me constantly. And that was that whenever, you know, in her memory or vision, Our Lord or the Holy Mother or somebody very interesting said something to her, she forgot it. She would actually say, but I forget what they said. And, you know, this is...
It doesn't
really
inspire much confidence,
not,
really.
No, I mean, this is not something that you want to adapt, you know. A really short memory, you know.
And yet there's...
It's a great opening.
It's a great opening, but that's it.
It's a great opening. They're specific.
He opened with a curtain line.
part of the curiosity is, I think it's been, you know, we've talked about it. It's been pointed out, you know, the fact that he falls off the bridge, and with that element, you know, he falls off the bridge. He's caught by the chains, and in Emmerich, he's going across a bridge and he falls off, and of course he doesn't not caught by the chains, but it's those kinds of things which make people say, well, did he have Emmerich open while he was writing it?
No, it's not very difficult to remember a scene like that, you know, if you've read it. But I think you find that Brigitte and there's mention of a bridge, and Brigitte and Catherine of Siena and mm-hmm. you know, Maria Greda, and I mean, Catherine Emmerich isn't the only one who thought of a bridge, you know, and the arresting soldiers throwing him over the bridge.
Right, right.
Also, I think just in terms of the creative process of writing, yeah. It would be very unusual for a screenwriter to prop, I mean, they're not, you know, screenwriters aren't necessarily like undergraduates, where they're going to prop up three things and then, you know, knock out a paper.
No, you can't do it that way.
I would imagine that even though if you read it and there's an image that remains in your head, you may work that image into what you're doing, but that's not, we're going to get Emmerich in here. It's an image. The way you were talking earlier about using the image of Jesus in the tomb with his hand, from a visual.
From an Andrea de Sarto, which has got nothing to do with it.
You incorporate images, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're...
Well, it's like saying that Mantegna, you know, must have looked at Paolo Uccello before he drew the body of Jesus in perspective, you know, lying, a corpse lying, you know, from a certain at a certain angle, so that it looked as if, you know, you're looking at it, you're actually lying down and looking at it, or just above it. Well, these are not conceits that mean that, you know, he was copying Paolo Uccello.
Sure.
You know, but probably there was somebody in those days who said, he's doing what Paolo Uccello's doing, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And this essentially is what I think that Mel Gibson was doing. You know, I remember going through a museum with him in which we were looking only at paintings of Caravaggio. And he was very interested in that because, of course, half of the story or a third of it takes place at night. And Caravaggio is a painter who paints very violent scenes, often that take place at night by torchlight or candlelight or, you know. And he is actually, one of his paintings, it represents Peter cutting Malchus's ear off. And it's a beautiful painting. And I remember Mel watching it, just standing there looking at that painting for 10 minutes, taking it in. This is what you have to do, you know, when you do something like
that. I was going to say, I have a slightly different perspective in your original question about the what gospel did you use? My perspective is this, and something that... it's not just my perspective, I mean, Mel and I have talked a lot about it, is that I keep saying that this film is an artifact, it's an art, it's a piece of art, it's not a documentary. But the important part behind that is the Gospels are already art. And what happens is that the Gospels are already taking an historical event and combining them with their spin, with the meaning they want to give, and combining them so that you can't pull them apart. So in the Gospels, you already have four works of art. That is four interpretations of event which don't always jive with one another, which is very important. And so what Mel is doing is the gospel according to Mel. I mean, people have said that sarcastically in the critiques of the film, but it's, as a matter of fact, it's not a bad expression. He also saw an historical event which for him was that suffering, human suffering, can have a redemptive quality. It's something he already pursued in Braveheart, as he was working his own spirituality toward finally the passion narrative. So in this respect, what he is taking is what he considers the core event, which is that the passion of Jesus has redemptive value, enters into the human situation from the inside and transforms it. And then he uses his artistic expression of the medium of film, just as the Gospels use the medium of words. But I think that's really important that... because one of the complaints about the film is, whose gospel are you following?
What does it matter?
And it, so what?
But that's been one of the interesting things, and we talked about that a little bit, because again, one of the criticisms has been, and one thing that separates the passion from the rest of the tradition, I think probably Clayton would agree, is that really what you have here is an intense focus on a very limited part of the gospel. So when you say this is the gospel, but where's the life and ministry? Where's the and that's been one of the that's been one
critique.
Of the one of the criticisms.
Yes, but one of the reasons behind that is that almost every portrayal of the passion, I mean, of Jesus's life, is the passion is downplayed. It's an embarrassment. So it's whitewashed, and for Mel that was simply unacceptable. He said, Mel. He suffered a lot in his own life, especially in the early 90s. He was disillusioned. He's very honest about it, with drugs, with women, with everything else. And he felt that he wanted a Jesus whose suffering spoke to his own. And, you know, and to have a Jesus who doesn't suffer in the Passion somehow did not address his own suffering and did not find the redemptive quality of it. And that was an obsession with Mill.
So this, well, much like it is in the painters who painted this,
indeed,
you know, and sculptors who worked on representations of it. And it is an artistic impulse. And, you know, the question, as you say, and rightly say, you know, which gospel? What does it matter to the artist? You know, it matters later to the people who are watching it. But in the end, a film is simply another painting. It's moving. And it really touches you or it doesn't. And the gospel that it's drawn from, it could be all four very easily. You know, it doesn't have to become, and it isn't, just one. I think that would be a mistake to think of it as just one.
I'd like to bring it back to a sort of narratologic look at the Gospels. And, you know, I guess this is sort of a question that anybody can run with. I can understand emphasizing the Passion, especially for a Catholic director, writer, whatever, in the same way that in a Catholic church you find a crucifix with Jesus on the cross, and your Good Friday's a big deal. I know, but for Protestants, Easter's a big deal, and it's what some of us consider an empty cross. So you've got that right there, that for Catholics, the suffering, as Bill was mentioning, the suffering has to do with the Passion. Okay, but what about all of the teachings of Jesus that have to do with social justice that is not there? Now, I'm not suggesting that you make another film or that you should have made a film other than the film you made, but none of the Gospels is just a Passion.
Mm-mm.
So what made you decide, other than some wonderful Catholic, you know, heated idea of human suffering as a paean to the Christ, what made you
it was
do that 18, that famous 18 hours?
Yeah, but that's what he wanted to do.
Is it, and this is, I mean, this is, I don't know,
he didn't
this,
want
I don't
to
know if this makes
else.
Sense, but,
okay.
I mean,
so it was
you
his,
weren't thinking.
Yeah, it was his money.
Yeah, it was his baseball and his bat, and so.
No, you weren't thinking, I mean, I thought of, when I saw it, I thought, I genuinely thought, why was Christ significant to Paul? Was it, I literally thought, is it, you know, how often does Paul talk about the parables? How much of Jesus' teaching does Paul draw out? And literally, I was thinking, in a strange way, what's the significance of Christ, you know, when you read Paul's letters? And part of me was thinking, well, it is Christ and him crucified. And that's, I wondered, I mean, I don't, you know, a theology of the cross.
Well, I don't know if Mel would agree with that, but I mean, but there is an element, you're definitely right about some part of his own way of looking at this. I think it's true that Mel is more interested in that moment, that day.
Yeah,
himself. I mean,
I was going to say that there's some tension in Mel's own thinking, which I think manifests itself in the film too. I think there's a tension between, say, a theology of atonement, which I don't like at all, and but the film can be read that way. Again, there's something that was discussed. All of us kept discussing these various possibilities, and I. And then a theology, a more Johannine theology of God transforming the human situation from the inside. But I think some of those tensions in Mel's own thinking keep manifesting themselves in the theology of the crucifixion,
mm-hmm.
which is the same thing I've mentioned before of not winning the battle about the resurrection. I felt that who am I? It's not my 25 million. You know, that the film, I would have liked to have seen the film end one of two ways. Either end with the ecce homo, I'm not with, I mean rather with the pietà, which I find the most powerful moment of the film, and just leave you asking, "What? How do I react to this?" Or if Mel is going to drag us in solidarity with Jesus' passion, and we're just wiped out by the time we get to the crucifixion, we're in solidarity with it. We should be in solidarity in the resurrection. Mary Magdalene should have been there, or by artistic liberty, have Mary, his mother, be there. Have somebody be there that represents us. And I felt that having just Jesus there as his victory, it should have been our victory. So, but there are tensions like that in the film, which are a lot of Mel's own ambiguity toward handling the passion in relationship to victory, toward resurrection, and so on.
Yeah, that's true.
He actually got a little angry with me on that one.
Did he?
Yes, I said, "Have you resolved the problem with the resurrection?" He said, "What problem?"
Which is, but you still got your check, didn't you?
I took out my check.
Oh yeah, that's good.
Wasn't very big, but.
Listening to all this, all of a sudden I had this feeling that are we, when we say, you know, what gospel is it from? What is the perspective of this? You know, is the Aramaic early Aramaic or late Aramaic? You know, is it influenced by this or? Are we acting like scholars and not like filmgoers? Are we not being an audience for a film, but are we looking at it with different eyes?
Well, I think, yeah, to some degree, I think that that's true. But I've actually talked to Mel about the fact that all of this should be continued.
Pixar.
Yeah. But I love the idea of doing. I love the idea if somebody actually commissions a triptych, you don't get the left panel telling the whole story. You don't get the central panel telling the whole story. You essentially get a. But there is a possibility on film of actually making something that would take us from the Old Testament to the New Testament, from that moment, the beginning of the New Testament, through the mission. To the passion, and it would be possible to do this. I mean, it's my fantasy, you know, that this would be a wonderful.
Like the Return of the Jedi.
Yeah. Of the Jeshua.
So are we starting in the middle of the story or at the beginning?
Well, no, I mean, I do. I remember Mel and I talking about this word because I like it. It's a Greek word, aletheia, you know. Not forgetting, you know, not crossing the river of forgetfulness. Aletheia. Nice. I don't know if they said it that way, but I like the way it sounds. We need some of that. And, of course, as scholars, we don't need that. But as a people, we need that. And so in that sense, to answer your question, yeah, we're not looking at it as an audience of a film. I mean, here tonight, we're looking at it, we're trying to pick at it, you know, and find things that are interesting to look at under the microscope of knowledge. But it's knowledge that doesn't really resolve anything, you know, to ask which gospel this comes from. It is a film based on the gospel that tells a moment of 18 hours in a way that's never really been done before.
Not trying to
whitewash anything.
You did it in a provocative way. It was definitely a provocative way. And actually, to come back to the narrative structure again, you chose one of the things you did. Yes, you told, you know, you gave us a circumscribed time, you know, the passion. But then, of course, you had the flashbacks. Mm-hmm. You had these places where you took us elsewhere. And I mean, well, most of them are flashbacks to biblical scenes, episodes, directly from the biblical text, more or less from the biblical text. What about the furniture building flashback? That was, I don't know if anybody else thought, where did that one come from? I was looking through my New Testament, trying to leaf through to find a furniture building.
Scorsese, when Harvey Keitel comes in while Jesus is making crosses, and you know, says, "You're a Jew killing Jews," in his wonderful Brooklyn accent, and I just assumed that that was, you know, part of the carpenter.
But what was going on there? Where did that scene come from?
Well, it was not something. I don't quite know how to say this. It was not my favorite scene in the movie either.
It kept changing during the shooting of it too. Shadow appeared a couple of weeks.
Well, you kept on saying move the table a little bit higher.
Yeah. Well, he wanted to make fun. He wanted some comic relief.
And that wasn't the, that, oddly enough. I mean, I just think that this was one film in which comic relief, you know, a sight gag is just not what you need.
I don't think the scene worked.
No, I don't think so either.
I don't think the scene of the flipping of the cross worked either, to be honest. Yeah. I blame you for that.
Yeah. Well, you can blame Maria Greda for that, because that was something that...
For the flipping of the cross. But it was impossible, the flipping of the cross. Because, I mean, the cross came over, and then, I mean, shouldn't Jesus have been like, you know, face right into
miraculous.
The... Face right into
space.
The...
That's why I don't think it worked. I don't think I was clear to the viewer at all. That was Mel's fault for not extending the chute beyond the extremes of the of the cross.
Oh, well, he's easy to blame. He's not here.
He would probably agree.
He does agree on that.
Yeah.
Right, because cross should have come over, the physics demands.
Well, first of all, you should have seen it, that the ground was flat. And then you should have seen the cross go over and the ground from beginning to the end of the cross.
Right.
Simply.
But what you see is something narrow.
What you see is you see a very narrow part. So
you don't see the stools at the outsides, at the other ends of the cross, holding it up, so that you know that it's not face down into the.
No,
yeah, but
you think the
ground is. Oh, come on, guys.
No, that's picking away at it. You know.
Of course.
But you know, there's.
I've been waiting to say that for a long time.
I know. It's Maria Greda.
That part's from Agreda.
That's part from Agreda.
It's not from Emmerich, but from
Agreda.
Now, my understanding was when Jesus fell, he pushed his right hand down first, and in the film, you show him putting his left hand down to catch himself. Why did you change that?
Well, these are tough questions to answer.
No, that's what we're getting.
I'm left-handed. I don't know.
No, what I'm saying is that some of these are filming... things that have nothing to do with the physics of the problem or how you would put your hand down. Mm-hmm. They have more to do with.
Well, in those cases, in the case of the work as a carpenter, I really didn't like that scene. In the case of Mary remembering him as a child, I did like that scene.
I do too.
And that's not in any gospel. And so that there is, you know, the freedom to occasionally... In fact, I remember Mel thinking that scene was corny. He said, it's way too corny.
Well, he kept changing it over and over. I mean, how many times did we shoot that? Then he kept asking for new dialogue.
Yeah, I know, but...
On the carpentry scene.
On the carpentry scene, yeah.
Huh.
And I, you know,
they're
I just never...
They're looking
never.
Underneath the slot, the table. Rye, are you hungry? I mean, all that would...
But I remember
that...
That
was variant number 27.
But the scene of her remembering him when he's a baby.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's the most powerful scene in the movie.
That's a very powerful scene. It's got nothing to do with any gospel.
Well, you mean, he's falling.
Yeah.
When he falls as a baby. But it seems very natural. I mean, it seems very natural because you can imagine. Yeah. And I think it does put the audience into Mary's... mind, I mean, in a very
that's true,
way but, cinema.
Yeah, but the natural works, whereas the other idea, which is to have him work as a carpenter and have a scene with Mom, you know,
flicking water in her face.
And like, what about the writing of the character of Satan?
That was interesting.
I didn't think it was interesting because on one hand, you seem to have Satan certainly at the beginning and the opening. You've got Satan saying, basically, of course, trying to dissuade, you know, you can't do it. You know, you won't be able, you can't do this. One person can't take all this on themselves, right? That you won't be able to do it. And then, of course, when the crucifixion happens, then you get that shot of the Satan howling, right? You know, obviously defeated, not wanting it to happen. And then yet you see the Satan ghosting in amongst the opponents. Jesus, right? You see the gliding, and it's so that does Satan want the crucifixion, or does he, you know, he, she?
Is that a foreshadowing of the next film?
No. Although I like whereas most people didn't like it, I like the idea of this mockery of the Madonna.
Yeah. Is that pageant. What that was?
Mm-hmm. Of course it is, yeah. Well, what else could it be? You know, she is a really strange and beautiful looking woman. And she's holding this dwarf, this hairy dwarf, who's just, you know, that's an awful, you know, mocking of the whole notion of the Madonna and child. And of course, this is going on during the flagellation, you know, partly because that's what the flagellation inspires. You know, you're just looking at everybody's reaction as way over the top. Don't you think?
Yeah, and when Rosalinda Celentano came in for the casting, she's the one who plays the Satan figure, she asked him, she's a very interesting figure, she herself, because she's anorexic and she's a cutter, she cuts herself, and so it's weird, a little worried about her. But she asked, what does this mean, the Satan figure? And Mel put his head down, and I thought it was just brilliant. He said, the evil comes in the form of beauty. And he says, but it's seductive beauty, but it's ambiguous beauty, but eventually it turns and bites you in the ass. Evil comes under the guise of good and beauty, as she does in the beginning, but ambiguous beauty. And so with the Madonna and child business, for example, the Rosemary's Baby scene, you see this mother and child, but all of a sudden the evil manifests itself in the horrible glance of the child and the ugliness. That's what Mel had in mind, that
right,
that sort of thing. But when he explained that to Rosalinda, he just sat back in awe at his... he just does that, you know, as he starts describing.
Very intuitive. He's a very intuitive intelligence at work, you know, and in large part, I think we worked well together. Also because we chose things as you did with him. You know, we're in agreement about most of what should be in there. And wherever it came from, you know, the line, for instance, you know, I make all things new, as we were saying earlier, is from either Revelations or Apocalypse.
It's
Revelations. And it makes sense. It makes sense, you know, even though... And to me, in a sense, it is probably the key line in the film.
What about writing the character of Pilate? Who was Pilate meant? I mean, were you sort of wrestling with the question?
Oh, we wrestled with that a lot.
Who is Pilate? And what is, you know, what's he doing here? What's going through his mind? I mean,
Pilate has been appointed as governor of Palestine, you know, and he hates it. It's on the, you know, far periphery of the empire, long away from Rome, and he's been there for 11 years. He can't stand it. He's had to put down rebellions, and his boss is Tiberius. Not a nice man. Not a nice guy. Tiberius is frightful. He's one of the most frightening of all of the crazy emperors. You know, we all think of Caligula and we think of Nero, but Tiberius was really bad. And he's been warned, no more. Don't want any more fights there. And Caiaphas knows this. They're going to put him on the spot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he has to explain his dilemma to his wife so that we understand it. And that was something to wrestle with, because you had to bring it down to, you know, literally a one-minute scene in which he explains what his problem is.
And why does Jesus speak Latin to Pilate? I mean, why at that moment? I mean...
Because he's a good Catholic.
No, because Jesus is a good Catholic.
No, right, was,
okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Is that Mel wanted Jesus to beat Pilate at his own game. So Pilate addresses him in Aramaic, and Jesus answers him in Latin. It's just purely an artistic choice to have Pilate think he's in a superior position, and all of a sudden Jesus ends up in a superior position. That's what he did.
It also surprises Pilate.
Yeah.
And you want to move away from what's been happening and have a governor of Rome whose instinct probably would be, well, who cares? Throw this guy to the dogs. What do I care? Now, suddenly he's interested.
And I have him stuttering afterwards. He's dressed in as king, I mean, as Aramaic and then Latin, he doesn't know quite what to do.
Something else I want to say about Pilate, if I might. This is, again, a difference between the script and the direction. Many people have complained that Pilate is far too sympathetic, a figure, and that Caiaphas comes across as the rat and Pilate is this gentle figure, you know, the thing. Well, I think that's an overstatement. But as a matter of fact, that was a question of direction, and the direction in this case was a question of the actor, of Christos. Shikoff is the John the Baptist, another...
I can't remember his name.
Sharpoff or something. That he, it's the way he played it, and Mel gives the actors a lot of freedom. And that was not Mel's original intention, to have him play that smooth and that gentle, but he let him run with it. But that's one of the results of that particular portrayal, which is not so much the script as it is the direction, is that people said that Pilate comes across as far too friendly for in their perspective.
Right. And whereas when you were writing it, did you feel like sympathetically?
No, I thought this guy is just another Roman governor. He's a weakling. He's going to do anything he can to keep his job and keep his head. He doesn't care one way or another about the people that he's governing. In fact, he hates them. But he doesn't, you know, he's above doing anything about it. He's been told he can't put down any more rebellions, and so he's going to try to stop a rebellion.
Right.
That's what he's panicked about. And he doesn't want to have anything like that go on. And, you know, I wouldn't want that to go on either if I were...
I wouldn't want rebellion either, which means that we should probably wrap up. If you've got one last question, and then we'll probably wrap up.
Where do you see this film, or where do you see the life of this film in five years, 10 years?
How's history going to remember this film, right? 10 years down the road, 15 years.
Let me say this: is that we're in the process of doing a special DVD with approximately 15 hours of additional materials on it, theological discussions. But you don't have to do all 15 hours. You can plug in. You can just get me talking about the language.
Would
it be theological discussions, artistic discussions, and that's in the works right now. There's also going to be a PG. He's making it a PG version to be re-released this Easter. It'll, of course, be only about 14 minutes.
Which is the attention span of most of us.
The 14-minute passion.
But it'll probably be released every year.
For kids.
What do you think, Ben? What do you think the lasting legacy is?
I'm a dreamer, you know, of dreams, so I don't mind telling you that I would love to see Mel Gibson, who has been enormously brave. Talk about a brave heart. I mean, really brave to do this film. Put his own money into it and did it the way he wanted to do it, and as an artistic exercise. Has done a film that it has made film history to this extent, that it has grossed more than most other films that have ever been made, except for Seven. It's number 8 on the all-time list.
In terms of restricted films,
in terms of an Aramaic telling of the Passion of the Lord, you know, it's really quite an accomplishment.
It's definitely the best-selling Aramaic
film of all
film.
Time.
Not that we should judge it only in terms of its box office, but I think it has a life as a part of a larger film, which I would like to convince Mel to make. But I don't know whether I'll be able to do that.
This space. Is that right?
So, to be continued, you know. In other words, as a fade to black is not bad. To be continued. You know,
this is the way. To be continued. Sadly, we cannot continue because you all need to get other places. But the only thing that remains to do is to
thank David.
Thank not only you two for joining us, Ben and Bill, but also Clayton and Allison. I think let's just, before we close tonight.
And thank you all for coming.
Thank you for coming.